I'm Stephen Hundley from IUPUI, and this is Leading Improvements in Higher Education, a service of the Assessment Institute in Indianapolis. Our sponsor for this season is Watermark, the largest global provider of educational intelligence software solutions for higher education. In this episode, we have a conversation about the future of assessment with three thought leaders contributing to a special issue of Research and Practice in Assessment, an online journal. Our guests are David Eubanks, Keston Fulcher, and Megan Good. Dave is Assistant Vice President in the Office of Institutional Assessment and Research at Furman University. Keston is Executive Director of the Center for Assessment and Research Studies and is a professor of graduate psychology at James Madison University. Megan is Director of Academic Quality and Improvement at Auburn University. She also serves as Associate Editor of Research and Practice in Assessment. I hope you enjoy our time with Megan, Keston, and Dave as we discuss future trends and opportunities related to assessment and improvement. Again, welcome to Leading Improvements in Higher Education. We are here with Megan, Keston, and Dave, and we're going to spend this episode talking about the future of assessment. Our conversation is informed based on forthcoming articles from Research and Practice in Assessment, or RPA. And I invite listeners to check out RPA at rpajournal.com. Dave, Megan, Keston, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Stephen. Good to be here.
Thank you for having us.
I'm delighted you're all with us. And before we get started talking about the future of assessment, and as we mentioned, this is based on articles in Research and Practice in Assessment, let's first begin learning a little about your backgrounds. We'd like to ask you to tell us briefly about your career trajectory, including what you do in your current role. We'll start with Dave Eubanks, followed by Keston Fulcher, and then come to Megan Good. Dave.
Yes, thanks for the question, Stephen. I like the analogy of a trajectory because it implies we're all going to come crashing to earth at some point, keeping us humble, right? So I started as a math prof at Coker College in 1991. It's a wonderful little liberal arts college. It's a great place to start. And I found myself 10 years later as an administrator in charge of institutional research. And then it's like falling off a ladder to be in charge of assessment and accreditation. I realized quickly that I didn't know anything about assessment and that we weren't doing it very well. So I tried to figure out, you know, what's going on and how to do this. And I wanted to mention the three resources that were the most helpful to me. One of them was the Assessment Institute. You may have heard of it. It's at IUPUI, and it's a wonderful place to connect to colleagues, find out what they're doing and network. It's an incredibly diverse group of people. So there's a rich froth of ideas. The second is AALHE, which is a national member organization for assessment people. I got involved with them when that organization was still fairly young. And I guess I was still fairly young. And finally, one of the most rewarding experiences was getting involved with peer review for accreditation to find out how, you know, smart, wise people try to make decisions about complicated sets of information and, in particular, assessment reports. So flash forward to today, I am at Furman University, where I oversee the Office for Institutional Research, Assessment, and Accreditation. But I really think of my job as trying to engineer a research platform for undergraduate student success. So about 20% of my job is data engineering, 60% roughly is doing analysis, and 20% is meetings and administration. I like to tell people that my actual title is Director of Exotic Plumbing, because that sort of captures it.
Dave, thank you for that introduction and your trajectory that clearly is keeping you still aloft, not crashing at all. And in your answer, you were mentioning the Assessment Institute. We appreciate the shout out there. But you also mentioned AALAG, which of course stands for the Association for Assessment of Learning in Higher Education. And I invite listeners to check out Season 1, Episode 2 of this podcast, Leading Improvements in Higher Education, to learn more about AALAG. Dave, thanks for your introductory remarks. Let's now turn to Keston Fulcher to learn more about Keston and his career.
Thanks so much, Stephen. I'm excited to be here. It's always a pleasure to stir the pot with Dave and Megan. We always have a good time talking about how things could be. So in terms of my background, I started off in assessment and measurement. So that's my degree. And then my first job was working at a small community college, Eastern Shore Community College in Virginia. And there I headed up institutional effectiveness. So I had a sense of how a college might operate, albeit at a pretty small scale. And then over time, I focused more and more on student learning outcomes. And that brings me to where I am today. So I'm the executive director of the Center for Assessment and Research Studies at James Madison University. And one unique feature about us is that we're tightly connected to a PhD program. So we have a PhD program in assessment and measurement. So the nice thing about that is if JMU runs into a really tough assessment problem, then we could just throw a dissertation at it and try to figure out how to do it a little bit better. Towards the future, I'm working on defining what it means to be a learning improvement architect in higher education, and one day I hope to become one. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Keston, thank you. And I should mention, Keston, this is a return engagement for Keston. He and his colleague, Caroline Prendergast, also at James Madison University, were featured in Season 1, Episode 6, where we had a deeper discussion about the Center for Assessment and Research Studies. Thanks so much. Finally, Megan, tell us about your background.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Stephen. I'm going to start back to my undergraduate days at Berea College because I learned about assessment as an undergraduate, which I think is a little unusual, but it was around 2008 when there was a lot of budgetary decisions being made. And it seemed to me that learning was not in the equation at all. It was just regrouping and it didn't feel thoughtful to my undergraduate mind. And so I had the opportunity to do an internship at the Center for Assessment and Research Studies. And that's where I met Keston and ultimately pursued both my master's and PhD at James Madison University. And Keston was my doctoral advisor, which was really great. And we thought a lot about learning improvement during that time. After I graduated, I came to Auburn University as the director of academic assessment and did that for 4.5 years. And in January of last year, I became our SAC-COC liaison. My title is now director of academic quality and improvement. And so I do a number of things, but our reaffirmation is coming soon. So that's the major one right now.
Megan, thanks. And for listeners who may not be familiar with SACS, could you explain a little more about what that organization does?
Yes. Yeah, so SAC-COC is one of, I believe, is it 7 institutional accreditors that are kind of the gatekeepers between federal dollars for students. And so reaffirmation of accreditation happens on a cyclical term. And for SAC-COC, it's every 10 years where you basically write a very big report to showcase you're in compliance with all standards that they have created.
Megan, thanks for that additional context and thanks for your introduction as well. Let me continue with you, Megan, for our next question. You are an associate editor of Research and Practice in Assessment, or RPA, as it's sometimes referred to. For listeners who may not be familiar with this journal, we'd like to learn more about its purpose and audience. Megan.
Sure. So RPA is a peer-reviewed journal focused on scholarly contributions to higher education assessment. And so it's a really great resource for those practicing assessment. And if you really want some meat behind, you know, research-based things to inform practice, it's a really great resource and a great outlet if folks are doing research and assessment to publish in a peer-reviewed place.
Megan, thanks so much. In fact, you're mentioning research and practice and assessment. Again, listeners can find out more at rpajournal.com. I'd also direct them to Season 1, Episode 17, where we had a conversation with 3 other editors of RPA. Those were Robin Anderson, Katie Busby and Nick Curtis. So Megan, thanks for that. And while we're speaking of Megan, we should mention that Megan will be the keynote presenter at the 2021 Assessment Institute in the Learning Improvement track that will take place later this year in October 2021. And listeners can learn more about that free virtual conference at assessmentinstitute.iupui.edu. So Megan, we'll look forward to hearing you and seeing you later this year in that capacity. For this next question, we will first come to Keston, then followed by Dave. So Keston, you and Dave were both asked by RPA, Research and Practice in Assessment, to discuss the future of assessment, and you were given the following question to address. I'm going to quote this directly here. Quote, if you are given unrestricted power to change assessment practice for the better over the next 10 years, what does assessment look like 10 years from today? What changes would you make over the next 10 years? And why are those changes needed? That's in quote there. So Keston, that was the challenge you and Dave were presented for. For listeners who have not yet had a chance to read your RPA piece, what are some of the main points that you are addressing? And what were some of the influences on your assessment vision? Keston.
Yeah, thanks so much, Stephen. First of all, that's a big question. That's the magic wand question. What would you do? And if you've got all that power, it's actually pretty scary because then you have to think about a solution with that power. So let me start off my response with sort of framing the problem. So the problem that I see it with assessment is that it's not achieving its purpose of improving student learning at scale. And so by its scale, I mean learning at the program level or the institutional level. So how do we fix this problem? How do we get improvement at a bigger scale? So one might think it might be by making assessment better. Better assessment should lead to more learning improvement, right? Well, it turns out that when some of the work that we've done at JMU and in other places, we found out even if you do world-class level assessment, that it rarely leads to learning improvement. So if I were assigning higher education a grade for its ability to improve student learning at scale, I'd give us an F. Not a zero, but certainly a low F. Because there are some institutions and some programs scattered about the United States and other places in the world deserve a better grade than an F. But overall, an F seems appropriate to me. So that got me and a few other folks like Megan thinking, if assessment is not the answer to learning improvement, what is? And this is where I get into my vision 10 years out from now, so waving that magic wand. So one piece I want to acknowledge first is that in this vision, a part of it is not to get rid of quality assessment. I still think we need it, but it's to subordinate assessment under a larger learning systems framework. And I'm going to blow that out a little bit. So to achieve better student learning, higher education has to organize many parts better, and assessment is only one of them. And learning improvement resides in faculty working together and making evidence-based decisions. Neither of these pieces, so faculty working together or making evidence-based decisions, is emphasized enough in higher education today. It's not enough just to have good instructors. It's how to meaningfully connect them so they can have a bigger collective impact. And so we need to structure higher education to support these types of connections. And anybody who knows me knows that I love analogies. So I'm going to throw another one at you. So imagine that we were trying to physically construct a building. And we would, of course, need great individual workers. People who know how to lay concrete, brick masons, plumbers, electricians, painters, and so forth. But even with all these talented people, there needs to be an overall organization. An architecture, and there needs to be a general contractor to organize the contributors. Further, each worker should have an idea of how their work relates to the overall project in some sense of what the other tradespeople are doing. Now, let's imagine that all these tradespeople came together and they were working on a building, but there was no architect and there was no general contractor, just a bunch of highly skilled people applying their trade in the absence of coordination. Imagine that building in your head that would come from those people sort of working hodgepodge together. Now, let's turn back to higher education, and you probably know where I'm going here. We have the academic equivalent of each type of these tradespeople who are very talented and hardworking, but operating in a woefully uncoordinated environment. So we've got faculty from various disciplines. We've got assessment coordinators, faculty developers, administrators, people from the library, and so forth and so on. the sum of their collective work is an educational hodgepodge. So I've used that word a couple times now. So what would it look like if higher ed got smarter in how it organized? How could these pieces be integrated to provide a better learning environment that produced more knowledgeable and more skilled students who are better prepared for the next phase of their lives? So in 10 years from now, perhaps we could organize higher ed to enable improved student learning at scale. An assessment can help tell and document this learning improvement story, but the big changes need to occur in strategy, structure, and professional development to build this better learning system. So I believe if we start going down this path of building up better learning systems, that it's possible for every institution to produce at least one program level learning improvement story by 2031. And that's my 10-year vision. Now, Stephen, you also asked me about what sort of influenced my thinking. So let me just give you a few real quick. So first, Megan Good, who is here, she and I have been thinking about learning improvement since, I think, 2012. So she and I have been partners for a long time. A couple other people, Charlie Blaich and Kathy Wise from the Wabash Center of Inquiry. I spent a lot of time looking at the assessment learning improvement connection. Monica Stittberg from University of Hawaii is excellent at connecting assessment with faculty development. And then there's a wonderful group of collaborators at my own institution who deserve a shout out. That's Sarah Finney, Kara Meixer, Diane Linding, Tom Dillon, and Linda Halpern. And finally, let me give a shout out to SAC COC, which is our regional accreditor, maybe 15 years or so that they've had something called a quality enhancement plan, where they ask institutions to think about doing some intervention that will change effectiveness or student learning. And having been part of several of those QEPs has really helped my thinking about learning improvement. Thanks so much for the question, Stephen.
Well, Keston, thank you. And it sounds like from your grade of F on our current, perhaps current assessment activities, you're giving us a little bit of academic probation here. You're describing a learning improvement framework for the future under which assessment and other activities need to be more coordinated, aligned, and produced and delivered at scale. So, Dave, you've been hearing from Keston about his assessment future. Let's hear from you some of the salient points from your research and practice and assessment article as well. Dave.
Thank you, Stephen. First, if I may, let me react to some of what Keston said, because I agree about the problem that, you know, the low F, I got a chuckle out of that as you were saying that. And it reminded me one time I was doing a grades analysis and I discovered that someone had assigned an F plus to a student. So maybe we can agree that the summative outcome is an F plus at this point. But a couple of things Keston said, I think are right on the money, that as a system, there are evident flaws and that those flaws need attention at this point. I don't think it really would require 10 years, and I don't think it would require omnipotence to solve the problems. I think to get started actually is fairly simple. It's just a matter of people caring enough to do it. I agree about the example of the QEP and the Southern Association. I've been a part of several of those and have found it very productive because it organizes the whole campus around a singular idea. And I think it shows the power of Keston's thinking about if we can harness the energy of all of these experts by motivating them in a single direction, then good things can come. I do have my problems with the way that the assessments of QEPs are done. And that really leads to my part of the article. I think it's important to note whenever I talk about changing assessment, I'm really associating it with the accreditation reporting, which comprises the large majority of the effort, and the budgets and the software and all of that. And to take a step back to think about how we got where we are, one of the original motivations was that we would objectively measure program learning so that we would have accountability. And this has deep roots, of course, and the accreditors deserve a lot of credit for saving us from standardized testing across higher education, which could have been a possibility. But somehow along the way, we shifted focus to continuous improvement without really evaluating the methods by which we were doing the assessments. So the assessments that we have in accreditation reporting are confined by rules that are more designed for objective measurement. They look a lot like standardized testing. And they don't work as well for continuous improvement, at least not generally. There are probably some programs that are quite happy with it, and I have no argument with that. But at the institutions I've worked at and many I've seen, the rules that we are stuck with for what constitutes an assessment report just don't work. So I agree with Keston. We need better systems for making decisions. And part of that, I think, does involve looking at the methods that are in place, really with the idea of flexibility so that we're not dictating to people how they know, right? We don't tell people how they are allowed to know as students are learning. So in particular, some of the changes that I would advocate are to intentionally address accountability as different from improvement and think about the methods we use as different. For accountability, you know, we can at least start with the measures that we have that are reliable and comparable across institutions, like retention, graduation rates, career, loan repayment, those indices. And then separate that from the assessment of learning and realize that the assessment of learning is really in the service of faculty development and program evaluation. Assessment isn't a goal by itself, which is rather what it looks like from the reporting structure now, but assessment should be simply a tool that's useful in faculty development and program improvement so that we can serve our students better. That's the goal. And then the cool thing, and this I mentioned in the article, is there's a synergy between the accountability objective measures and the learning outcomes, flexible, whatever works for you measures, and that is research on grades. Somehow, for decades now, the research on grades, course grades, and what those mean to students has sort of fallen through the crack between accountability standards and student learning standards. So that we just, as assessment offices, haven't spent much time on it, and we are discouraged from doing so by the major accreditors. This is really unfortunate because grades are so important if we want to understand equity of success for students, if we want to understand barriers. Grades determine whether or not you can take a course or be in a major. Sometimes students lose grants because their grades get too low. Employers look at grade averages and so forth. And also, of course, the faculty are very invested in grades because they spend a lot of time on them. So one of the immediate opportunities is to relax the rules on assessment so that we can expand our research scope and more flexibly move between the accountability and the learning outcome world. That's it in a nutshell. Let me tell you very briefly one influence. I'm a very slow learner, and it takes me a long time and a lot of experience to finally grasp something, I think. But I was chairing an accreditation review, and the assessment person on the review committee was in the process of marking down the school's assessment reports. And in my recollection, he confided to me in this moment of self-reflection that, you know, his own reports at his school, where he was the assessment director, were also not in very good shape, implying that he wouldn't have passed his own standards for review. And that caused me to think, well, yeah, probably mine wouldn't either. And then, you know, the consequence of that, maybe we all are marking each other down for a system that isn't really designed very well. And that that sort of launched a lot of critical thinking that then resulted in my public advocacy of the need for change.
Dave, thank you for summarizing your article. And again, like Keston, you're focused on a future that is flexible and improvement oriented. Megan, you've been hearing from Keston and Dave, and of course, you've read their articles. You've heard about them describe their assessment future. Let me ask you a couple of questions. First, what was the impetus in asking them to design this future? And then what are some of the important integrating aspects from both of their articles? Megan.
Yes. So to your first question about what was the impetus in asking them. So as Keston mentioned, he and I have been thinking about things for almost a decade, I guess. And one thing starting back in around 2012, we would always talk about is what we called fantasy land, which other people call blue sky. But it's just the idea of if you could just dream up something better, what would it look like if you suspend all disbelief? And our idea with that was if you can't figure it out in fantasy land, then we have no chance of ever making it a reality. And so that framework of brainstorming is something Kess and I have always sort of done. And I've, you know, even years ago, I followed Dave's writing in, say, Inside Higher Ed. And as he said, you know, I don't know if he says directly, Dave, but kind of blowing things up and stirring the pot. And so I've always admired Dave for that and had the opportunity to talk to him over the last year about more of his ideas. And I thought, you know, these are two people who are really thinking about what fantasy land could look like, and they have ideas for moving us in that direction. And so, you know, I shared that idea with Nick and the editorial board, and they thought it was a good chance for us to think about doing a dialogue piece, because most of the RPA articles are research-based, but we thought this would maybe at least move the conversation to a more future-oriented space. And so that's the background on this conversation. And then about integrating aspects, I think Dave's already summarized them, and you too, Stephen. The two really big things is one, there's just with both Keston and Dave, I feel and read a sense of dissatisfaction and frustration with the status quo. And we are doing a lot of reporting across the country. And is that the best way our energy can be used? And when we really think about the students, is that the best time and effort across the country that we can do for them in this framework of assessment? And the other integrating piece is that it seems that both Keston and Dave are putting assessment in the backseat and putting faculty development in the front seat and recognizing that assessment alone is just a tool, no matter how it's defined. Even if we expand assessment to include grades and other data, the data alone will never do anything magical. We have to actually pair that with interventions and thoughtful systems to help people do better. And so I think those are the two big things I see.
Megan, thank you. And again, these articles are appearing in Research and Practice in Assessment, the focus on the future of assessment. And those articles are accessible at rpajournal.com. Dave, we will come to you first for our next question, followed by Keston. So Dave, in your ideal assessment future, is assessment reporting still mandated? Why or why not? Dave.
Thank you, Stephen. I don't think reports are going away, but I think they could be more meaningful. The student success reports or student achievement that I mentioned with respect to graduation rates and things like that are useful because the data are reliable and comparable. They are by no means perfect. But I don't see those kinds of reports going away because they are a primary means by which the public can assess how an institution's doing. The current assessment reports, like for accreditation, which is really the target of my charges for change, I think those particular reports could go away at no loss, because what they do now is they confirm that we adhere to a system. We go to a huge amount of effort and expense to show that our institutions are following a particular set of rules. Philosophically, those rules are supposed to go somewhere and take us somewhere good, but as Keston and I agree, that they don't. So I think it would be better if we rolled the assessment reporting, such as it is, into the reports for how do we show that we are developing faculty and doing program review. That is, we include the whole scope of what constitutes the mechanisms for student success in a program. That could include what sorts of students do you admit to the program? What is the sequence of course, you know, the core courses, and what are their success rates? What are their success rates for different demographic groups? Why do you think the grades in your Calc 1 class are reflective of Calc 1 learning? And in conjunction with teaching and learning centers and the professional standards of program review, that makes a very nice package that's flexible enough. It's not bound by a bunch of artificial rules. And we already have standards that deal with that in accreditation, and they could be expanded if need be to make them richer. But I think that's a natural home for the function of what's now the assessment report. I think the assessment report per se has outlived its usefulness. I don't want to minimize the positive impact of the assessment movement on faculty development and program review, but I think the natural evolution at this point is to complete that story and move assessment closer to those functions. That's, in fact, what we've concluded in my office, that we need to be hand in glove with the Teaching and Learning Center. So in short, I think the reporting could be greatly streamlined so that assessment offices are not not occupied full time with a list of check boxes that they have to complete in order to feel like that they've met the standard.
Dave, thank you. And Keston, you're hearing Dave describe the reporting heavily associated with the assessment movement. And Dave is arguing and advocating for a more holistic treatment of what occurs in programs and in institutions. Keston, talk about assessment reporting in your assessment future. What role, if any, does it play?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen, and thanks, Dave. I do agree with Dave that the way assessment is currently conducted and reported out to regional accreditors hasn't been all that effective. But for me, I would keep the student learning outcome reports, and I would keep that reporting, although it likely wouldn't look the same 10 years from now. I believe that bad assessment and the bad assessment reports are symptomatic of that disconnected learning system that I was talking about before. So I'd start working on the upstream machinery of the learning system first, and then think about how to integrate assessment into institutions better. So, you know, my view isn't quite as extreme as Dave's on, you know, doing away with the student learning outcome reports. I still think they're useful, but again, I think we've got to fix some things up at the upstream level in colleges before we start thinking about what those reports would look like. Thanks, Stephen.
Keston, thank you. For this next question, we'll stay with you and then come to Dave. In your new system, why would faculty and administrators be more motivated to apply these data to drive change than in the current system of assessment? Keston.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. And I want to acknowledge one thing I really appreciate about Dave is he's big into using data too. Both of us think that we don't just collect data to collect it, that it should be useful to the institution. So with that being said, let me start off by saying how faculty and administrators apply data to drive change is highly dependent on how that process begins. And I'm going to expand on that point by contrasting how assessment is traditionally posed to faculty up front and then provide an alternative. So the traditional approach often looks something like this. Faculty are told to do the checkbox type of assessment that Dave has referred to, and then they're asked, how are they going to use that information? So what do you think is going to happen in that scenario? It's pretty hard to get inspiration from a process that was done in a just enough for compliance mindset. So let's imagine another way. Imagine I approach a program and ask the faculty, when your students graduate now, what skill or knowledge area is holding them back from greater success? Why does this skill or knowledge matter? And would you be willing to work with your colleagues to help students get better in this area? And in my sort of limited experience, but some experience with asking these types of questions, most programs will actually say, you know, yes, if you give them the opportunity to think through what that skill might be. Then once they say yes, I'll say, well, let's get working on this improvement project. It's going to entail some assessment to see where students are and where they will be, but the focus is on your collective effort on changing the learning environment. So now assessment has a context, and it's being used to inform and tell a learning improvement story. But again, the emphasis is not on assessment per se. The emphasis is on the faculty working collectively to strategically change the learning environment. So Stephen, in sum, I'm not beginning the story with you must do assessment. I'm beginning the story with what do your students need to be more successful? And then wrapping assessment and other infrastructure around that question.
Keston, thank you. And Dave, you're hearing Keston describe how to get the buy-in from faculty and administrators. Continue with your remarks. Dave.
Thank you. I really appreciated your response, Keston. And I think very similarly about the importance of stories. You know, stories usually start with Act One, where we're introduced to characters. And if we don't care about those characters, we're probably not going to make it to Act Two. And over the years in working in institutional research and assessment, many times I'd come up with something that I thought was interesting and maybe even useful, and then take it to the stakeholders who could actually do something about it and find out that they didn't really care about it, or they had some opinion that was at variance with the data, and that opinion was more powerful because they were the ones making the decisions and so forth. So over time, I've sort of taken a bottom-up approach, which is like, you know, managing upwards maybe. And at my current institution, the way we do that is we have a group that meets weekly with behavioral scientists and myself and my staff. And everyone around the table has some influence with the administration, so we can get things changed. And this seems to work pretty well. It's not perfect by any means, but it allows us to then focus on the data that's coming in, the methods by which we're gathering the data, what we think about it, how that thinking changes over time, and what our big agendas are. Always with the kind of external pressure, because the Board of Trustees and the senior administration always are asking for benchmarks with respect to student success indicators, of course, but also including things like engaged learning, complicated assessment questions like, well, we're spending all this money on study away, for example, could be a question. How do we know that's worth it? And so we have to wrestle with, you know, hard questions that come down to dollars and cents at the board level, and we can't simply be content with you know, philosophical answers. So I think in my view, this is what seems to work at my institution, but I don't know what works at other institutions, which is why I would advocate a flexible approach. It probably a lot depends on the character of the leadership and how interested they are in data and how sophisticated they are using it. So again, the flexibility of their approach, I think, would be the key, and allowing institutions to find their own way and some combination of student success and student learning research that fits their budget and is, you know, suitable to their goals and mission. I should say that higher education needs to modernize with respect to data. It's ironic that we have the academic departments producing all of this technology and machine learning and so forth, and we seem like we're the last ones to actually use it. So one of the things I try to do is advocate the use of automation and reporting to save time and make it more accurate and so forth. So all of this infrastructure and data gathering can more easily produce findings that potentially will be used by the leadership. So I don't think there's a simple answer, Stephen. I think it depends on institutional culture. And the bottom line is we need the flexibility to adjust our methods and means to the institutional culture, not be mandated from the outside and have to spend a lot of time and effort on something that we know doesn't work for us.
Dave, thanks so much. So Megan, you've been listening to Dave and Keston describe the future of assessment. And of course, you come to this work as both a scholar and practitioner. So what strikes you as both interesting and exciting about what Keston and Dave are proposing? And what are some of the challenges that you see in what they're articulating for the assessment future? Megan.
Yeah, so I mean, to be honest, I'm just excited we're having this conversation and thinking about the future and dreaming up ways that it could look differently. And I think just by hopefully not ending the conversation here, but continuing it, we can push the field to open up in a different way and spend our energy in perhaps different ways than we are. And so to me, that's most exciting than any particular idea. I'm constantly thinking of how, in my mind, what Keston and Dave are describing independently could work together to be a new model. I think what they're saying is more similar than different. And I've just, during this conversation, been thinking about Georgia State and the amazing work that they've done with graduation rates and retention rates. And they really organize themselves, as my understanding as a non-expert, to focus very intentionally on how to do that and organize offices to work together in that way and create innovative technologies. And I think, you know, to Keston's learning system point, I think that's what we need. We need to think about the goal and organize ourselves that way. But Keston, just to share a critique, I think about, you know, 10 years ago, we might have said, well, everyone does assessment. What's the end goal of that? And we would have said learning improvement. And I do wonder if we went all in on learning improvement and we had these beautiful reports that documented improved learning. Of course, that is good for the students, but is that going to shift hearts and minds across the country in any way? I'm not convinced that it will. And so I really like this, the idea that Dave is suggesting, and I'm trying to put them together, of thinking about student achievement broadly and almost asking programs to level up on one of these metrics. Maybe it's learning, but maybe it's their placement rates or their graduation rates. And all of those things are interconnected in some way. And if everyone's working on improving, I think that could maybe get the ear of senior administrators and leaders and also parents, perhaps more so than only sticking to learning. But I'm just brainstorming and trying to think of, you know, how these two pieces fit together.
Megan, thanks. And you're certainly describing a work in progress that Dave, Keston, and you are co-creating for the future. Dave, let's now come to you for our next question first, followed by Keston. So in what ways would higher education broadly, the higher education sector, be served by your future system? Dave.
Thank you, Stephen. Again, I'm not really advocating a system, but a more flexible set of standards by which institutions can spend their assessment dollars. But I think the payoff is, as Megan mentioned, the success with Georgia State, I think, is a signal example of what can happen when an institution puts its mind to increasing student achievement. And one of the reasons, you know, those graphs are compelling is because the metrics that they're using are reliable and understandable across institutions. So I think the student achievement side is achievable with these kinds of examples, and that if we integrate it with the student learning instead of segregating the two as two different projects, there will be a fertile ground for new development of ideas. And particularly, I mentioned course grades. With respect to learning, if we freed up the assessment offices to work more closely with professional development offices like teaching and learning centers and program review, and let them work with faculty to find whatever kind of information is the most suitable for the program that they're working with, to be completely flexible. And for example, to read the literature and find out that at JMU, they discovered that in biology, if they used this method, it improved learning. And so instead of having to try to reproduce that research on my really small sample size at my institution, I could just benefit from their research and get credit for that. That's not baked in to the current assessment reporting. Everyone is supposed to discover everything on their own all over again. So I think there's, you know, the flexibility hopefully would allow resources to be oriented toward more payoff, frankly, in both student success and student learning. You asked about stakeholders. The primary stakeholders are the accreditors and the leadership of our institutions, which make up the boards of those accreditors. I think, you know, as humans, once we believe something, it's very difficult to change our minds about that. And there are an awful lot of beliefs that are unchallenged about the usefulness of assessment practices as they are advocated for assessment reporting. We have to challenge those before we can get anywhere. So we have to change minds. And I think that will happen. In my work with the accreditors, these are amazing, dedicated people that do enormously beneficial work. And I'm very optimistic that we can get their attention and allow some more flexibility.
Dave, thank you. So, Keston, continue building on what Dave has said with your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. First, I want to respond to something that Dave said that really resonated with me. So he said, gosh, wouldn't it be great to know what things worked to improve student learning and be able to sort of mix and match across institutions to help each other out, as opposed to, you know, reinventing the wheel at every institution. And that's a similar conversation, Dave, that I've had with my colleague, Sarah Finney. And we talk about this term like evidence-based a lot, but what does evidence-based mean? I used to think that it just meant that we would look at the evidence of our own institution, look for strengths and weaknesses, and maybe do something different for the areas that we had weaknesses in. But there's also another way of thinking about evidence-based too, that there's many researchers out there who have studied interventions and what works and what does not. And why should we at different institutions and different programs try to build these, you know, programs and interventions from scratch when a lot of people have already done the studies for us? So that's kind of my point, is that we should be looking at evidence-based both ways. So what evidence do we have locally? And then what's the evidence that's out there about what's already effective? So that being the case, going back to your question, Stephen, so what ways would higher education be better served by your future system? So this is this learning systems approach. So in my opinion, the degree to which we affect student learning is our most important contribution in higher education. It's analogous to profit in business or quality of life in healthcare. So organizing to achieve better student learning outcomes should be at the top of any college leader's mind. And I say that, and I know that Megan just disagreed with me. She said, well, maybe it should be, but many leaders don't care about it. And Dave, there's a question that you said you might pose to me about how do you integrate student learning and learning improvement with other things like admissions and job placement. Please ask me that question, because I think it gets to the point there. Thank you.
Well, let's do this. Since you're both willing to pose some questions to each other, why don't we ask you both to do so before we come back to Megan and talk more about research and practice and assessment. So let's ask each of you, Dave and Keston, to pose to the other a question that you'd like to ask. So Dave, we'll ask you, what question would you like to pose to Keston?
Thanks, Stephen. Keston, I very much enjoyed this interchange. I've learned a lot. So my question is, how should student success work, like admissions, course completion, graduation, career indices, and so forth, intersect with learning assessment?
Yeah, thanks, David. I really like that question. And Megan and I have had this discussion before, so let me kind of fess up with my own role. What I've been thinking about a lot is assessment within that 4 years that a student is at JMU. We typically look at undergrads and think about how we can change students so they can have better outcomes when they graduate. But in terms of trying to connect that student learning outcomes data with admissions or with what happens to students later, we haven't been as good at connecting those dots. And I think Megan is exactly right there. I think there needs to be a lot more work in connecting student learning outcomes to, for example, job placement. So let me give you just one example about how they could be better connected. And I want to acknowledge that Megan has really influenced my thinking here, that imagine that we looked at a particular program and looked at students' job placement and, you know, how many got jobs and how many didn't. And for those students who didn't get jobs, why was that the case? And often it may be the case that there were poor skills. So the students didn't have the skills graduating from the program to qualify them for getting that job that they need to have. And if that's the case, then we said, hey, there's this disconnect between job placement and what students are learning. If we did a learning improvement project to increase students' skills in that area, and then students had a better job placement rate, I mean, oh my gosh, that's the holy grail, right? Because you connected student learning locally at the institution with what's important outside to the work world. Then I think people would care. But we're not even close to that for now. But maybe, Megan, kind of going to the 10-year vision, maybe we can do more of that. Is that's connecting student learning outcomes that are meaningfully both internally within the institution, but connect to that job placement afterwards. So again, Dave, I love that question. Thanks for posing it.
Let me come before we ask you, Keston, to turn back and pose a question to Dave. Let me ask Megan to react to what she's hearing as well. Megan.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to clarify. It's not that I don't think people don't care about learning. You know, I think everyone cares about learning. It's just assumed. It's like the given, you know, and so people don't see it as a problem. And maybe it's not a problem. It's just about wanting to really level up. And improvement kind of implies that there's a problem. And that's why I like this more flexible framework, because to your point, Keston, if we focus on placement rates, or if we focus on something that's much more tangible to our external stakeholders, we know that learning is right there under the hood and connected, and it's all integrated. But to focus solely on learning is not going to get everyone really excited, because they don't know exactly what it means, but they do know what it means to get a job. They do know that students and their families are investing a lot of money in this. And so to the degree we can think of it as a package of success and achievement might be just more palatable to folks across the country outside of the faculty.
A package of success and achievement. Megan, thanks for that reply. Keston, your turn to ask Dave a question.
Okay. And by the way, I love this format. I think it's fun to ask each other questions. So Dave, if SAC-COC or another regional accreditor said, Dave, you're the point person for coming up with the new standards on student learning assessment reporting, like how would you word it so that it would not elicit checkbox responses?
Thank you. Great question, Keston. It's a big, complicated question, so let me just give a couple of possible bullet points. First of all, I don't think there's any way to prevent checkbox reporting completely. It has to be a continual leadership issue. Ideally, the assessment reports, as I mentioned earlier, would get integrated into the professional development or program review so that the standards as they exist now would just go away. I realize that would take a lot of time. The interesting thing to me is that the standards as they are written across the major accreditors are not prescriptive. They don't have all of these rules about what data you can or can't use written in the policy. Those all come externally. And it would be really interesting to map the history of how we develop this culture of what we think is appropriate or not that goes far beyond the standards. And in other standards, this is simply not allowed. Committee members cannot just make up their own requirements. You have to go by whatever's written in the standard. But in this case, it seems acceptable that the student learning outcome standards can only be satisfied if a whole list of unwritten rules are also applied. So I think the simplest solution is just to say, no more unwritten rules. We go by what's actually written in the standard. And as with all the other standards, the institution gets to make its case for compliance relative to its own mission.
So Dave, both you and Keston are really describing a culture that requires flexibility, leadership, and a holistic treatment of student learning and institutional effectiveness. And Megan, you've been listening to all of this and just having Keston and Dave describe their assessment future. Let's pan back a little bit and ask what's on the horizon in contributions you see coming to research and practice in assessment. What can readers of RPA look forward to in the future? Megan.
Sure. So readers can look forward to continued articles that are research-based on the practice of assessment, but they can also look towards learning improvement-specific articles in our learning improvement corner. And this has been a pilot for us of the dialogue piece that we hope starts a conversation. And so if this format is successful, then we might consider having additional guests to come in and think about the future and debate and struggle with new ideas, which I've really enjoyed, but we'll see how our readership reacts.
Megan, thank you. And of course, we've been talking about the future of assessment informed from contributions all three of you are making, Megan, Dave, and Keston, to research and practice in assessment. And listeners can find out more at rpajournal.com. As we draw our time together to a close, I'd like to ask each of you to leave our listeners with a brief final thought. Well, first, Megan, come to you, followed by Keston and then Dave. So Megan, a brief final thought from you.
Sure. So I guess for me, it's just heartening that we all have the same goal of really focusing on what's best for students and not forgetting that the purpose of higher education is about student learning, at least in a very large way, although that can differ in size and scope at different institutions. For me, it's just, I encourage all of our listeners to think about how we best organize ourselves and use our time to most effectively help faculty help students learn. And how do we think about our own contributions and how we might be shifting our field to do that better in the future?
Megan, good. Thank you. Next to Keston Fulcher for your final thought. Keston.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. As we think about a larger learning system, there are some activities and some development that listeners can do right now. So I'm assuming most listeners are involved with assessment. And if that's the case, I encourage them to teach a class, because to be able to interact with faculty, it's good to know what kind of experiences that they've gone through. And I also encourage them to sit in on workshops by faculty developers and maybe even volunteer to work a little bit in the faculty development office to see how that piece fits. And if they work on those two pieces, so have some experience teaching and work in faculty development, then I think that the assessment will, they can see how assessment might fit into that bigger picture, and they'll be able to connect the dots in the learning system. Thanks, Stephen.
Keston Fulcher, thank you for that final thought. And we come now to the final thought from Dave Eubanks. Dave.
Thank you. Here's the advice I would have liked to give myself 20 years ago. And that is, with respect to assessment, there are a lot of people who make claims about what works and what doesn't. And they do so very confidently. And I would tell myself that claim may or may not work for you. Test it and see, and don't believe just because you can't get it to work that it's your failing. It may be that that system just doesn't work in your situation. Don't keep trying it over and over again if it doesn't work. Try something else.
Dave Eubanks, thanks so much. We've been speaking with Megan Good, Keston Fulcher, and Dave Eubanks on the future of assessment, all informed from contributions to research and practice in assessment. And I should acknowledge, research and practice in assessment is a valued partner of the Assessment Institute. Megan, Dave, Keston, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, it's been fun.
This has been Leading Improvements in Higher Education, a service of the Assessment Institute in Indianapolis. Learn more and access other episodes at our website, assessmentinstitute.iupui.edu. Our sponsor for this season is Watermark, the largest global provider of educational intelligence software solutions for higher education. Learn more at watermarkinsights.com. Our podcast producers are Chad Beckner, Caleb Keith, and Shirley Yorger, with original music composed by Caleb Keith. If you know someone who might enjoy the podcast, please encourage them to give us a listen. We appreciate you helping to spread the word. I'm Stephen Hundley from IUPUI, inviting you to join us again for Leading Improvements in Higher Education.